So I'm just going to introduce very briefly my two colleagues, James McGuire and Ivor McGrath. Since this programme was drawn up, James McGuire has become an adjunct professor at UCD, so I just want to apologise for the residual Mr. James there. And James, of course, was a much beloved colleague here, retired recently, is the author of many publications on early modern 17th century Ireland, and most recently was honoured with a Festschrift called People, Politics and Power, which was written by a number of his many students over the years and deals with early modern and 18th century Ireland. And Ivor McGrath is not a retired colleague, a very busy and active colleague here in the School of History and Archives, and is also a historian of the 17th century in Ireland. And James is going to speak for, I think, about 40 minutes or so. And then Ivor, we decided, because there is now a dictionary to be used, Ivor is going to respond to the dictionary from the viewpoint of a researcher. So without further ado, James, thank you.
Good. Well, thank you very much, John. I'll help recalling that the last time I gave a paper on the Dictionary of Irish Biography, it was just a year into the period when we got funded, 1998, a long time ago, in this room, that is. I could put papers on elsewhere, so it's nice to return now, feeling that at least it's done, or at least. Can I start off with an Irish Times leader? And it's a leader from August 1938. It's a quiet time for news, or whatever the technical phrase is, a bad day or a slow day for news, obviously. So the Irish Times run a leader headed National Biography. It's not a very long leader, so I thought I'll take the liberty of reading it to you. He says, one of the duties of a community to praise famous men, but I make no comment, but it is a duty which may be placed, quote, on the long finger. That this has been its fate in Ireland is known to all who have occasion to consult works of reference. There is no authentic or official dictionary of Irish biography, although the need for such a work has been recognised for a very long time. It is true that there are certain works which may be utilised as a foundation for such a work when it eventually is undertaken. And we owe all these works to the disinterested labours of patriotic individuals, to Webb's compendium, and the more recent work of Dr. Crone. Irish students owe a great debt. And it is not too much to say that the labours of these devoted men have placed the entire community under a sense of obligation. However highly we may regard the limited researches of Webb and Crone, taking back a bit of the earlier praise, and a host of lesser contributions to the growing body of biographical material, we cannot overlook the fact that a comprehensive dictionary of Irish national biography has yet to be compiled. Nor may we attempt to dispute the need for the collaboration of many minds in the work of compilation. We have now many schools of history in our three universities. That's an interesting anticipation of a term that doesn't become common for another 70 years or so. Anyway, we have now many schools of history in our three universities, and it should not be too much to ask of them that some attention may be devoted to the preparation and publication of such an essential work of reference. On the financial side, which may assume preponderant significance as the work proceeds, that's very true, we would bespeak assistance from state funds, no less from the government of Northern Ireland than from the Exchequer of Mr. Sean McEntee. Much material might be rescued on suitable terms, I like the word rescued here, on suitable terms from the famous Dictionary of National Biography, which is an enduring memorial to the foresight and energy of the late Sir Sidney Lee. Poor Leslie Stephen gets left out. And the names of many famous Irishmen enshrined suitably among their great compatriots. Now that Wales has decided to give to its people, and to all to whom it may be of interest, a dictionary of Welsh biography, the example of that little country may act as a stimulus to Ireland, to the preparation of a worthy dictionary of Irish biography. All the scholarship of the country should be attracted, and we would commend the immediate consideration of the work to the universities and the government. Now, that was dated August 9th, 1938. The Irish Times recommendation of immediate consideration in 1938 came just a month before the Munich crisis and a year before the outbreak of war in Europe. It was not, in fact, until the 1950s that the idea of an Irish biographical dictionary was revived, when plans began to be laid for an Irish biographical dictionary project to be based in the National Library. These eventually fizzled out, but the desirability of a comprehensive dictionary resurfaced in the later 1970s, when it would appear, as I personally remember, on the agenda, usually the last item, of the Irish Committee of Historical Sciences. In the 1980s, the Royal Irish Academy began a pilot scheme to investigate what needed to be done, and this moved a stage further in 1992, when the Academy began to assign on an ad hoc basis additional money which allowed temporary staff to be taken on and the exploratory stage to be expanded. By 1996, Cambridge University Press were persuaded to be interested. It was the most hopeful and yet the most frustrating period in the project's history, for a comprehensive dictionary was simply not possible without guaranteed annual funding. All changed early in 1997, when the Academy's HEA grant was expanded to cover the costs of maintaining a project capable of producing a multi-volume comprehensive dictionary. The pilot stage was now over, and research, writing, and editing could begin, with a real prospect of completion and ultimate publication. So 1997, I believe, was in truth the year the DIB that was published on the 18th of November last year, that was the year, I believe, it actually began. In 1938, the Irish Times had complained that there was, quote, no authentic or official dictionary of Irish biography. I'd like to think there is now something authentic about the edition we've just published, but there is still no official dictionary of Irish biography, and I hope there never will be. The RIA's Dictionary of Irish Biography was published simultaneously, as you must probably know, in print and online. The print version is in 9 volumes, has 8,361,484 words, and 42,000 cross-references. That is, you know, QVs, and in the print version, the electronic version, these are underlined, you click on them and you go to the reference. And I'm particularly proud of those 42,000 cross-references. And it covers over 9,700 pages, 700 subjects, some of them co-subjects, in 9,014 signed biographical articles. These articles, or entries, to use the more usual term for a work of reference, describe and assess the careers of subjects in all fields of endeavor, including politics, law, religion, literature, journalism, architecture, painting, music, the stage, science, medicine, engineering, entertainment, and sport. And there are more besides. Now, how do you become eligible, provided you get to get into the dictionary? Well, while the project was still at the pilot or exploratory stage, we drew up eligibility rules for dictionary subjects. They didn't mean you're entitled to get in, but they meant you're eligible to get in. These required that subjects must be, one, either born in Ireland with careers in Ireland, born in Ireland with careers outside Ireland, but there the bar is a little bit higher, born outside Ireland with careers in Ireland, and above all, you must be dead before the 1st of January 2003. People of Irish descent born outside Ireland have not been included, unless they had careers of significance in Ireland. Certain famous figures who happened to be born in Ireland have also not been included, simply because their birth in Ireland was fortuitous and had little bearing on their subsequent careers. Such individuals are more appropriately covered in the biographical dictionaries of the countries in which they made their mark. We were criticised in a recent review for saying in the entry for the great cricketer Sir Tim O'Brien that he'd scored the most runs of any Irishman in first-class cricket, when this apparently was a distinction held by Freddie Fane. In fact, Fane just happened to be born at the Curragh Camp. His father was an army officer, never played for Ireland, and hasn't even made it into the Oxford DNB. Outlining the significant Irish careers of those born outside Ireland is an important element in the dictionary's remit, as the history of this island has clearly been greatly influenced by the actions and policies of non-natives. Many of those who held important offices in Ireland or exerted real influence while in Ireland have been included. In this respect, the essential criterion for selection is presence in Ireland. Thus, a figure such as William Ewart Gladstone has not been included, despite his preoccupation with Irish events and his profound influence on Irish affairs, since he never held any Irish office and only visited Ireland briefly. On the other hand, Eamon de Valera, Oliver Cromwell, and St. Patrick were deemed eligible. De Valera, I might say, was included in the British DNB supplement for the 1970s because, in the words of Lord Blake, that volume's editor, Eamon de Valera was an American subject, yet to admit someone whose career was so deeply involved in British politics would have been to disappoint a legitimate expectation. So that's the grounds. They had him in the 70s in their supplement. Of course, he's now in the Oxford DNB as well. And as for who else from outside, well, the kings of England would be an example. How many of those have gone in? Well, the only ones were the ones who came to Ireland, not on sort of visits like Queen Victoria, but those who actually came and did something significant. And the kings of England who have made it to the DIB are Henry II, King John, Richard II, James II, and William III. How do we select subjects? Well, there are no absolute rules for choosing subjects for the dictionary, but a number of criteria were useful in establishing the names to be included. Among these were the posthumously famous or notorious, contemporary figures acknowledged as significant in their own day, but subsequently forgotten, those unrecognized in their day, whose achievement or significance has since been recognized. For example, you find this among scientists or sometimes medical figures. The holders of high office, whom a reader might expect to find in a National Biographical Dictionary, such as a senior government minister and Archbishop of Armagh. Those who achieved high professional recognition, including distinction in scholarship, science, or professional life, even if little known to the general public. Those associated with particularly well-known events. Innovators, reformers, pioneers. For example, the first woman to hold a particular office or enter a profession. An example here would be Avril Deverill, who was the first woman to actually practice at the Irish bar. Those with intrinsically interesting careers. And you read some of, say, Patrick Morham's entries, I think you'll come across a number of those. As a National Biographical Dictionary, the DIB cannot give the kind of blanket coverage of a particular field proper to specialised biographical dictionaries. We have not, for example, included all the members who were elected for the College Green, Westminster or Stormont Parliaments, nor have we included all who sat in Dáil Éireann. Comprehensive inclusion of parliamentarians would have left little room for other subjects. Though somebody once commented, an advisor back in the early days, surely you're including all MPs. Well, if we did, there would have been virtually very little room left for anybody else. I was asked recently how we found names for inclusion in the DIB and how the final choice was made. The answer to the latter question is simple enough. The final choice was made by James Quinn and myself. But finding the names involved multifaceted activity. In the early stages, the project had taken advice from expert panels in some specialist areas, including science, and from individual experts in particular fields. All this information was put up on the project's database, along with the names of all subjects in the one-volume biographical dictionaries published by A.J. Webb in 1879, J.S. Crone in 1929, and Henry Boylan in 1979. Not to speak of the extant Bahaish Naish volumes, edited over the past 15 years by Dermot Brannoch and Maureen Ivaricu. The database, the DIB database, included too all Irish names or names connected with Ireland in the old DNB and the Canadian, Australian, and American National Biographical Dictionaries. Not to speak of names from myriad other sources and lists. This database was the original brainchild and the work of one of our colleagues in the DIB, Dr. Linda Lunny, and it's increasingly, I think, important resource and will be in the future when we can get it tidied up and made available, we hope, on a wider basis. We worked off this database, which now has well over 60,000 names, and from it we marked up those we're going to put in. We also actively investigated particular themes or careers, including sport, where we had, I'm happy to say, in-house experts to rely on. But nearly everybody is an expert in sport in some way or other. But narrowing the choice to just over 9,000 entries was one of the most difficult tasks facing us as editors. There is a core of names on which almost any group of editors would agree, but at the margins there is considerable scope for disagreement. No set of choices can meet with universal acclaim, and a different set of editors might well have names chosen for inclusion. And different set of editors might well have had different names chosen for inclusion. But no set of choices can meet with universal acclaim, and a different set of editors might well have chosen different names for inclusion. In the end, we endorsed in the dictionary, in the introduction to the dictionary, the words of Brian Harrison, joint editor of the 2004 edition of the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography, when he wrote of how, quote, serendipity and practicalities influence the final selection, quote, a point which needs to be remembered by anyone embarking upon a quantitative survey of the dictionary's contents. I think that's a good comment to make, and that's why we quoted it. I might add that in 1997, we had not decided on all 9,000 names. And even as late as 2002, we were deliberately holding back from filling our quota so that we would have some flexibility to include names that came late to our attention. And I think this paid off, because it meant that, you know, names did come over those 4 or 5 years as we were getting nearer, going further down the line, many entries already written. We could then add in extra names as well. So we didn't mark up all 9,000 initially. Some would argue that the prime function of a biographical dictionary is to gather together the lives of those who rose to prominence and distinction in their own times. For this reason, biographical dictionaries are sometimes criticized as elitist works, the products of an old-fashioned view of history that concentrates on the deeds of statesmen and soldiers. By contrast, the Dictionary of Irish Biography's editorial policy has been to give primacy to achievement over position. Holding an important office in itself has generally not been regarded as sufficient to merit inclusion, unless that office is really like, you know, Taoiseach or Archbishop of Armagh, as I quoted earlier. Rather, it is what an individual did with that office that has been judged the crucial determinant. While it has not been editorial policy to include relatively obscure persons as representative types of ordinary lives, the dictionary nonetheless encapsulates what might best be described as non-elite careers. In the case of military figures, for example, distinction rather than rank has been the main criterion for selection. Together with numerous commanders, the dictionary includes ordinary soldiers whose conspicuous bravery on the field led to contemporary fame. While many of the names chosen for entries have, of course, been included in previous biographical dictionaries, a great many more are given biographical treatment for the first time. Furthermore, the editors have not automatically included or excluded individuals simply because they had entries in other dictionaries. Hard choices have had to be made. The only way to make room for the many interesting and important figures thrown up by recent research has been to cut back on some of the administrators, ecclesiastics, and soldiers who formed the bulk of the entries in previous publications and whose careers now seem less important than they once appeared to be. Our abiding criterion has been to include those names which seem most likely to be the objects of inquiry in the 21st century. Though current interests can wax and wane. For example, the old DNB, that's Leslie Stephen and Sidney Lee's DNB, carried a number of entries for Irishmen who fought in Afghan campaigns of the British Army in the 19th century. In the late 1990s and up to autumn 2001, there seemed no particularly pressing reason why we need include them in the DNB, but some are there now. I can remember James and myself saying to each other, oh, another Afghan warrior, do we really need him? And then suddenly Afghanistan takes on a whole new significance from 2001 onwards. The dictionary has created greatly benefit from that recent broadening of historical interest into new fields of study. This has introduced many names that might have been ignored in the past, especially so in the case of women. Many earlier biographical dictionaries tended to give pride of place to achievements in areas such as politics, religion, and the military, spheres from which women were generally barred. The dramatic growth in research and publication in women's history has substantially changed the agenda for a work such as this. We have therefore not only included many pioneering women who broke into traditional male spheres like the natural sciences, but have also tried to provide accounts of outstanding practitioners in what have often been, though not always entirely accurately, been seen as traditional female occupations such as arts and crafts, midwifery, philanthropy. The number of women in the dictionary overall is proportionately small, just under 10% of all entries, which is inevitable if one considers the profile of women in the medieval, early modern, and the parts of the modern period. But if you examine the number of women given biographical treatment in the 20th century, the percentage totals are a little less stark. If you look at all DIB subjects who died between 1914 and 2002, the number of women of biographies rises to 15% of the total. And if you take the period 1950 to 2002, the percentage becomes 17%. In the Oxford DNB, as published in 2004, women accounted for 18% of the 20th century entries, but only 10% of all entries. So we're very sort of close to each other in that. There was no, obviously, deliberate policy here. This is as it worked out. And how do subject numbers break down chronologically? As you'd expect, subjects who died in the 20th century, that's for which I take the years 1901 to 2002, dominate, with 4,052 lives, or 41.6% of the total, with 19th century lives coming to 2,486, or 25.5% of the total. A contrast here, by the way, with the Oxford DNB, where the 19th century accounts for 30.5% of the total, and the 20th century comes in at under 29%. This, I think, most probably reflects two things. One was that the Oxford DNB kept all subjects in the old DNB, and the 19th century had been grossly over and self-indulgent in the number of really very unimportant people it put in the later 19th century. And, of course, the late Colin Matthews, a very admirable man, but he himself, too, was a 19th century scholar, and I think he had, he had largely, before he sadly died so tragically, he had put together the 19th century section. But it's interesting here that we're way ahead in 20th century entries, and actually the 19th century is the dominant one in Oxford. Compared with the Oxford DNB, our treatment of the pre-1200 period is significantly stronger. In our case, with 524 lives, or 5.3% of the DIB, compared with their 3% of the Oxford DNB. We also approach the pre-1200 period differently, giving separate entries for most subjects, whereas Irish subjects in the Oxford DNB were in many cases placed in group articles, excellent in themselves, but making individual subjects hard to find, and in the process defeating what I regard as the principles that should govern biographical reference works, that it is a work of biography, and that you look under a name rather than under a general description. The medieval period, which I have taken to cover those who died between 1200 and 1500, it's not exactly very exact, but you have to, statistically, it serves its purpose. This period accounts for 536 lives, or 5.5% of the total, whereas the 16th and 17th centuries combined account for 1,119 lives, or 11.4% of the total. As between, by the way, the two early modern centuries, the 17th, I'm afraid, is the clear winner, with 72% of those who died going in, those who died between 1601 and 1700, 72% of those are 17th century subjects, or 17th century deaths. This 18th century comes out with 1,200 lives, or 10.4% of the DIB. A word of warning, by the way. If you use advanced search on the online DIB, you will get a figure well below 200 for the number of pre-1200 lives. The online DIB, I think it's good, but it's going through teething problems, and this is a result of a coding error. So I tried this out myself, put in the dates, 0100 up to 1199, and only 100 and something names come up, which left me a bit shocked. I also put in, by the way, only this morning, the name Patrick, nothing came up. Well, the first one that came up actually was in the 11th century. Then I put in St. Patrick, again nothing came up. Put in Patricius, came up. So there's something wrong here, coding problems. These are teething problems. There's nothing to do with our policy, I rest assured. I was determined, in fact, that the pre-1200 Ireland would be well represented. But finding names for that period, and indeed for the High Middle Ages, brought us into uncharted territory, as neither period had received anything approaching adequate treatment in earlier reference works. Now, I'm not talking about scholarly works, but reference works, in the way that later periods, from 1600 right up to the 20th century, had indeed been already noticed in the old DNB or in the shorter biographical dictionaries I've already mentioned. So there was a pressing need to establish a list of names from which the 1,100 entries for early and medieval Ireland could be drawn. For the period up to 1199, Alva Mac Hauron and Aidan Breen came up with a comprehensive list, on which they then enter their recommendations according to DIB guidelines. Now, we had these internal guidelines, which ran something on this basis. A equals must, B equals should, C equals might, and D equals need not. And we often asked our experts to vote on that basis. In this whole process, the pre-1200 period, Professor Padraig Ó Rian of UCC was the presiding authority, and he gave a huge amount of help to the project. And very valuable advice, too, came from Maureen Evueni in Cambridge. From these deliberations, then, emerged the 524 pre-1200 lives. The 536 lives for the 1200, the 1500 period, rested on very generous advice from Sean Duffy in TCD, Catherine Sims, and Robin Frame. The latter gave advice, which came as a salutary warning, that Gaelic medieval Ireland should not be seen exclusively in terms of O'Connors, O'Briens, O'Neills, O'Donnells, but that Leinster should get adequate treatment, a challenge which a former, I think, fellow of the Micheál Ó TÉirí Institute, Emmet O'Byrne, took up with gusto. Content of articles. Well, as far as possible, a Dictionary of Irish Biography article contains comprehensive factual information, details of birth and death, family, education, the chronological sequence of a career, with starting and finishing dates of main appointments, the dates of milestones and careers, and details of significant awards, distinctions, or promotions. While every effort was made to find such basic biographical information, in some cases, of course, it was simply not available. In addition to providing the essential factual material, the editors encouraged, wherever possible, an assessment of the significance of an individual's career, especially in the longer articles. Personal relationships and characteristics, including human failings, are commented on where they are relevant, but they're not dragged in just for their own sake. The editors have indeed made every effort to ensure that dictionary articles, with the exception of some of the shorter articles, are more than mere catalogues of events, but attempt to appraise the circumstances that shape lives, such as ancestry, parentage, education, physical and social environment, and other formative influences. And while articles have been written according to in-house guidelines, these have not been enforced with what my board of editor colleague Theo Hoppen, if he's one of his favourite adjectives, calls Procrustean rigour. And we kept that in the introduction. Contributors have, for example, been encouraged to include relevant anecdotes and incidents that illuminate subjects' careers. Certain biographies present special problems, not least biographies for those who died in the decade or so before our cut-off date of the 31st of December 2002. With primary sources not usually available, there was a natural sensitivity about what could be written about the recently deceased. In general, the lives of such individuals do not lend themselves to the same degree of scholarly assessment as those of earlier subjects. In a number of cases, the biographies of major figures who died recently have been written by contributors who knew them or are particularly well informed about their lives and times. Such articles are often based on personal knowledge or information supplied by family and friends, and may in time become primary sources for future historians or biographers. Most entries cover the subject's career from birth to death and frequently end with an assessment. good example to take of this is Ronan Fanning's, I think, excellent entry for Shaun the Mass. Being a long entry, it is subdivided under headings. I give you the headings. Early life. In opposition, 1922-32. In government, 1932-48. In waiting, 1948-59. Taoiseach, 1959-66. And finally, assessment. But compare this with headings in the entries, say, for St. Patrick or Columbkiller, subjects of considerable importance, but which of necessity lack extensive biographical details. So Patrick's entry, for example, has the following subheads: chronology and career, Ireland and Roman Britain, Patrick's mission, Patrick's learning, remembering St. Patrick, writings attributed to Patrick, non-literary aspects of the cult, the insignia of a saint, the late medieval and post-medieval saint. In other words, his much later reputation. So you can see there's a completely different sort of emphasis there, an appropriate one. A long entry, a very long entry, not as, quite as long as the Mass entry, but a long entry. Very important entry, I think, written by someone I really think that I was absolutely delighted with, even though I'm very far from being an expert in St. Patrick. But very different in structure, as indeed would be the case of a number of similar entries from, say, an entry, say, from somebody from the early modern period up to the 20th century. Now, what about the length of articles? Well, articles in the Dictionary of Irish Biography range in length from about 200 words to about 15,000 words. Some actually are even short. There are a few below 100 words for some of the very early period. The main consideration determining length was the importance of the particular career, but other considerations have also had to be taken into account. Lack of sources, for example, has meant that some entries are shorter than would otherwise be warranted. A paucity of written sources can apply to a variety of groups, such as early medieval subjects, craft workers, sportsmen, and even modern entrepreneurs, few of whom seem to have left substantial written records. Yeah. Clearly, some careers lend themselves more readily to extensive treatment in biographical dictionaries than others. The achievements of the writer, the artist, or the architect tend to be tangible and often long-lasting and may be written about from generation to generation, while those of the performer, the stage actor, the barrister, as opposed to the judge, the singer or the musician, at least in the age before film or sound recording, tend to be more ephemeral. In many cases, the length of a particular career influenced the length of the relevant article. Versatility, too, has had a bearing on length. Individuals who distinguished themselves in a number of different areas generally required more extensive treatment than those who distinguished themselves in one. This is pretty obvious stuff, but it's worth saying. Naturally, we discouraged prolixity or repetition, but at the same time, we took a positive view of longish entries for second-line figures, such as novelists, poets, politicians, on the ground that they might never get full-scale biographical treatment in monograph form, be published, but yet were of sufficient importance to be memorialized as comprehensively as DIB space would allow. In the case of a subject not born in Ireland, and whose time in Ireland was short but significant, the Irish career takes up the greater part of the word allocation. Though the career outside Ireland is summarized sufficiently to place the subject's time in Ireland in a wider context. The dictionary also includes several hundred lives which are treated as co-subjects in longer entries. These are articles within articles, usually on family members or collaborators whose careers are best understood if dealt with in this way. Co-subject entries are highlighted by bold type within an article in the print edition. A good example here would be very much in the late medieval period. You have what almost amount to family entries, where you have the family name. It's not a thematic name, but a family name. But therefore, you might get a number of generations of the same family being treated in the same article. A lot of, indeed, of our 14th, 15th, early 16th century entries would fall into that category. A broad range of views, interpretations, and literary styles is to be expected in a work written by 700 individuals. We've had three main criteria for each entry, we as editors. That should be factually accurate, based on the most recently available sources, and accessible to the general reader. While contributors happily agreed to follow these editorial guidelines, they were encouraged, as we put it in the introduction to the print version, and we meant it, to interpret individual lives in ways that they themselves found apposite and true. Indeed, the editors believe this to be one of the major strengths of an enormous cooperative enterprise, which has involved contributors from both sides of the border in Ireland, from Great Britain, continental Europe, the United States, Canada, Australia, and elsewhere. External contributors, of whom I'm sure there are a number here in the room, I might add, wrote for us without remuneration, which was extraordinarily generous. In some cases, even for short articles, it was generous, and for those who did the major long articles, it was extraordinarily generous and hugely appreciated. Now, is it all over? Is that the end? Well, my talk is nearly at an end, and it'll be time for Ivor to take over, but I just want to say the Dictionary of Irish Biography has not come to an end. We are contracted to produce twice yearly supplements to be added to the online edition. These supplements will initially focus on those who have died since December 2002, but they will carry too lives from the early period right up to 2002 that were not included for whatever reason in the first edition. We'll also be correcting and revising the existing entries, and we will welcome comments and advice from those who have spotted error of whatever sort. All we'd ask is that the advice be relayed to us by email or letter rather than by phone, because we find that if people phone, sometimes good advice gets lost. So we encourage you to write. But we really do encourage, and we've already noticed that the number of blogs that have been opened on the dictionary is expanding by the day, also other comments in various places. And we welcome all this, and all we hope just that people will see the big picture sometimes and not see the niggling detail, which sometimes can happen. But the detail we do want to get right, and if error is there, please tell us, and we will have in place, we hope, sometime after Easter, mechanisms for inserting corrections where errors have occurred in the online edition. So I think, John, that's all I have to say.
Thank you. I think before we take questions or comments, a sort of reader response from Ivor now.
All right, thanks, John. Sorry, I've got a cold, so excuse me on that front. I have to stop to blow my nose. I suppose as an early modernist, particularly interested in the 17th and into the 18th century, like most people here, I'm sure, over the years I've become very accustomed to using various multi-volume biographical reference works. I suppose it's how I would look at where the Dictionary of Irish Biography fits into. And the hard copy, this seems to be the term we would use now, the image here is of volume one of the 9 volumes that you can get and lift up onto your shelves if you're strong enough. Volume one covering A to Birchall. As an undergraduate student, James was the individual who directed me first towards the old DNB, which was the first sort of large collection in that respect that I used in the library here, and various volumes were falling apart and they were usually out of order and you go looking to try and find whichever volume you're looking for. Following on from that, I worked for and have made great use of the ongoing production of the History of Parliament Trust's volumes, multi-volumes on the Westminster House of Commons, and more recently the 6-volume Edith Mary Johnson Lick's History of the Irish House of Commons in the 18th Century, beautifully produced 6 volumes on that. At the same time, what was always glaring while using those volumes was the absence of a Dictionary of Irish Biography. And it was in the 1990s when I was away doing my PhD in London that I came back and met up with James at some point, and he informed me of what he had undertaken to do. And it was at that point that I realised and knew that we would have a Dictionary of Irish Biography, because they put the right man in charge of it. And we've all can see the fruit of that long labour. But I knew for sure that day he told me over, I think, a cup of tea and a scone, that's what he was up to, that I knew it would happen. It's always been the case that better undergraduate students and most postgraduate students make use of these biographical reference work, make good use of them. But what has become noticeable in the last few years, since the publication of the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography, is that with an online version existing, that a whole new way of engaging with that material has become available to undergraduate students, and more undergraduate students, I mean postgraduate students have always made use of this material, are willing to, because it's an electronic resource and they don't actually have to go into the library, are willing to use that resource, and we make the most of that that we can. And that's one of the reasons why we now have the online Dictionary of Irish Biography here in UCD Library, and that's what I'm going to focus on here for a few minutes, because again, from a teaching perspective, I think it's going to be hugely useful, and not just from our own personal research perspectives. And I suppose I come to that from, it's that new dimension. I'm still one of those people who love to have the hard copy up on the shelves, that you can take it down. But there are, at times, problems that arise out of that. Take, for example, the six-volume History of the Irish House of Commons in the 18th Century. I found myself at times with a table not big enough, with all six volumes down and open as I'm trying to go through a list of contributors to the first loan to government in 1716 in Ireland. Of course, you know all their names, I'm sure. But anyway, I was going through it, trying to find all these MPs, etc. It does become quite difficult, and they fall off the desk. The online resource provides you with something that you can't do with the printed volumes, and that is you can jump immediately from A to P, or whatever it is, without having to get up and get another volume. Now, where I came at this from was last semester, myself and John were teaching an undergraduate course in early modern Ireland, and one of the documents that John gave us all to study was the preface to, if that's the right way to put it, the introduction to the first printing of the Book of Common Prayer in Irish in 1609, I think, was it? Yeah. And while our students had been quite efficient at using the Dictionary of National Biography online to get little potted biographies of people like St. Ledger and Sidney and others, they could not come up with an answer to the question of who was William Daniel, the name at the bottom of that piece. And most of them didn't realise that he was had just also been made Archbishop of Tuam. I was intrigued by that because, on the one hand, they couldn't find it. On the other hand, I was intrigued because it's not my area, but I was like, okay, here we've got a man of Gaelic Irish origin as an Anglican Archbishop. It makes sense why he's involved in the translation, but how many more are there? It's not my area, and I know there are people who could probably tell me off the top of their head. I know how many more there are. But what I was intrigued by as it was emerging, as our students seemed to be understanding, was that there was a great fluidity in the nature of the Reformation and the emerging Counter-Reformation in the 16th century, from the 1530s onwards, that in the early years, at times it appears as if even government officials weren't really sure what the difference was between the new Reformed Church and the older Church, and how did that impact upon who emerges as bishops, be they Catholic or Protestant, and at sometimes both, as became apparent. And the online Dictionary of Irish Biography earlier this week provided me with the start of a lot of those answers, and that's one of the genius things about having something like this online, that you can so quickly start doing, finding. It's not just the name. And what I did first was I put in William Daniel. I want to see, okay, what is there as a biography if I was a student coming to this? And under the simple search, you can see here on the homepage name, I typed in William Daniel, and up came, found four matches in 16 milliseconds. Very happy about that, I was. The second of whom was the individual I was looking for, Daniel, William, and then O'Donnell, a couple of versions of his name in Irish. Church of Ireland, Archbishop of Tuam, and translator. Chap I was looking for, immediately go to the biography. And this is the brilliant thing about the online resource, but also the danger of it, is that it's so quick and easy to go to all those that are also mentioned there, because I started reading it, okay, New Testament in the Irish, son of Nicholas Daniel of Kilkenny, and then I saw, influenced probably in becoming a Protestant by the energetic Church of Ireland Bishop of Ossory, Nicholas Walsh. Now again, others may know that name, I didn't, so I clicked on that QV link, then Nicholas Walsh came up there, and it took me to the biography of Nicholas Walsh, with his name also given in Irish. So I was intrigued at this stage, as I was looking, starting to read through that, and I saw he was the son of Patrick Walsh. I'm a postdoctoral research fellow of that name here, so that also, I thought, right, interesting. So I was already heading into, and again, finding, okay, so here are some Church of Ireland bishops that are, for me, already illuminating the fact that we're not just talking about New English arrivals ending up as bishops, Anglican bishops, but also Gaelic Irish, Old English, and that it's something like this, as opposed to the very useful but very restricted list that you get in the New History of Ireland, Volume 9, of bishops pre and post 1534, post 1534 broken down into both Catholic and Anglican. But there's not really very far you can go with that, other than finding a name. Here is where you can start to find the answers that lie behind those names. So I thought, how would the search engine work if I tried something other than names? What about Anglican bishops? So I put that in, and I came up with, found 709 matches in 13,993 milliseconds. Took a little bit longer. I wasn't so impressed at that point. But of course, what I discovered too is that it's pulling up everything, anything that has Anglican in it and has bishop in it. As you can see here, clearly Aid died 598, was not an Anglican bishop. This we can, I'm sure we can be certain of. But of course, I was again distracted like a child. Ooh, I want to read about Aid. And then I saw second line, Colum Killa, so I wanted to read about him too. So I went in there, and I was getting quite carried away at this stage and realised I was totally gone off track from what I was meant to be doing. So I thought I'd get back to that. Now, there's an interesting button here, and it's one thing that I like about anyone reading a computer screen. We hate to have to scroll down. We hate text to disappear off the page. I like this. Expand. You can if you want, or you can move on. Right, it's not really what I want. But that works very well, expands it out. Now, I did move on because I had got distracted. And I went back to my Anglican bishop, 709, and thought, oh, look, here's an interesting button I've never found. Another search engine, reverse order, rather than click through however many pages that might be or whatever, which does exactly as it says, and brought me down to the last, into the W's. Of course, I had Walsh still in my head. So instead of doing what you can do here is a search by relevance, name, birth date, death date, etc., I just press 2 to go to the next page, and there's my chap, Patrick Walsh, pops up again. And it was then that I was struck by, back to what I was thinking about, Church of Ireland and Roman Catholic Bishop of Waterford and Lismore. What had started out as a question in an undergraduate seminar, through this, using the DIB, had become for me a very interesting journey as to, say, many of you may know who these people are. I didn't. And so I wanted to know, how could he be both? How did that work? And of course, he fits quite well with what, for me, was starting to gestate, that prior to Mary's reign, it's very fluid. You know, he's appointed, but it's not really clear, you know. I think it says at this point, and was consecrated on 23rd. At this time, it says, I've lost it there now, anyway. But that it's very fluid up till Mary's reign. He goes right, even though he's had three children at this stage, in Mary's reign, he gets absolution from Reginald Pole, and he can continue on as a Catholic bishop, and then with Elizabeth's succession, he goes back to being an Anglican bishop, though it remains slightly uncertain about how committed he is to all of this. But yet, he's part of a bigger picture there, and I think that biography in itself, I mean, I got there very, 709 wasn't a good result for my search, so I got a little lucky finding him. You can then, I thought, right, I'd like to keep this one, view a PDF, which I did, saved it, and then I thought, well, I should really find out how to cite it. All of this comes under Article Services. It told me to click Export Citation, which I did, it's there, and then it gave me the option of downloading the HTML format, or emailing the citation to me, which I thought was excellent, so I did that, and it did email it to me. And then struck me that I should try to use the advanced search. Again, the primary focus here is on the name, but I was trying to see what I could get in terms of a theme or a subject area. So I moved down it, and it does provide you with, it says you've got, selection is required for birth, death, so I selected death. I wasn't really sure why, I just thought I would. I had to select one of them. And then I clicked Ireland, and it selects all the counties, which suited me, and Anglican. I then realised that I could do a refined search on that, which I did. I put in male. From what James has said, I probably didn't need to do that, that it might not have been an issue about female turning up at this earlier stage. And I put in religion as another search, and it reduced it to 182 matches in 228 milliseconds with those search terms. And immediately, again, in terms of the one thing I hadn't come across in my list of bishops, and you see I only looked at the first few, is that classic laziness with a computer, just read what's on the screen. Bernard Adams, Church of Ireland Bishop of Limerick, born in Middlesex. So I felt I'd found all three. I have a new English arrival, and I felt happy at that stage. And so I decided I would move on and try, what about Catholic, Roman Catholic archbishops? Or bishops, I should say. And again, I put in as a search here, bishop, religion, Catholic, and that was pretty much it. And it came up with 160 matches. Now, not surprisingly, again, I didn't read off the screen, what we were seeing here was more 19th century bishops turning up. But in a way, I thought, well, I know there's a way around that because I actually know some of the names. And I felt I couldn't finish this up without going to a name, if not a person, who at other times in James's life has interested him greatly. Of course, James Butler, first Duke of Ormond. But I was more interested in that New History of Ireland, Volume 9, two James Butler Catholic bishops in the 18th century that I knew, for one, didn't know anything about. And I entered that, and brilliantly, they're the first two individuals that came up. We came up with 17 matches, the first Duke is there, the second Duke is there, but the two first James Butlers are the two Catholic Archbishop of Cashel and the Roman Catholic Archbishop. Oh, both Catholic, there you go. Both of them were Archbishop of Cashel. I went to look at the first James Butler, and I should say one of the things I really like about the way this comes up is it gives you the author under the title. You don't have to go searching for it. You know who the author is, and that matters to me at any rate. I like to know who's writing these things, particularly if I know them. But I start in reading this, immediately again, the child in me saw Christopher Butler, and I needed to go and find out about him, and I did, because again, earlier, 1673, 1757, why I was interested in that, again, because he's transcending that whole period of the introduction of the penal laws, the banishment of and at that point I felt, right, I've really said enough, and I really need to stop. But what I would say to finish up is that even that brief search through it inspired me towards going back to it, and more importantly, getting students to go back to it, because there is so much that can be made of that, made of this resource, and I'm awfully glad that UCD Library has purchased the full and proper version of it. So thanks, James.
Thank you.